School just got out for the weekend and the children walk home, some running and skipping, others impossibly slow. A few stick around to play while there is still light in the sky.
Over here, come on!
Like these three. They're filling a wide mixing bowl with a little water from the fountain, then scooping snow into it with their hands.
Did you bring the eggs?
No,
I did. Let me see.
They've brought large spoons from home to play their favorite game, and one of them, the oldest of the three at fourth grade, remembered to bring boiled eggs that she painted with her mom the night before.
Look at this one.
So pretty.
Wow.
They set up their spoons around the bowl, place their delicate eggs, and count down.
Three, two, one, stomp!
They stomp on the spoon handles, and the eggs fly. One goes long, another wide, and the third lands clean in the middle. And then this, every time. A child wins, the giggling, and the cheering, and the chatter, it all stops. They stand quietly as the winning egg slowly turns in the slush, its painted lips and eyelashes running. After a minute, the kids perk up and go do something else.
Let's go to my house.
I have to ask my mom.
No, you don't.
That moment of quiet when the game ends, no one tells the kids to do it. They don't give it any thought. As far as I can tell, it's instinct. And it may be the only dignified act in this town. Children standing quietly for a full minute as if they know. The real story. My story.
You're listening to The Cold Plunge, a radio play by Sunny Blickinger. This is Act 4.
It began 100 years ago. Even more further back with Val's great-great-grandfather. You might call him Valevchenko the First, but to us, he was Valentine.
Where's my wig?
It's next to your false nose.
I looked there.
Look again!
Valentine and I, we led a troupe of performers, mostly actors and singers. Half of us could double on instruments. We sang the numbers and played the parts, some for laughter, some for love. We charged enough to get by, stay a week or two, and then move on. St. Petersburg. Moscow. Самара. Екатеринбург. Челябинск. Красноярск. And all the villages in between. Back then, times were hard and everyone needed comfort. There was much talk of food and shelter, warmth, medicine. But with simple costumes and the barest of stages, we provided the one thing no one thought possible. Rest. A moment to forget and let go, if only for an evening. It didn't take much. A few bows touching strings, an actor steps onto the stage, fully committed. She speaks her line and the entire audience, which entered exhausted and suspicious, they would let go. Collectively. Their shoulders heavy, their breathing slower, deeper, their faces now soft with wonder. There was one act that thrilled them all. I would dress as a woman, and Valentine would beg for my love. Audiences fell off their chairs, actually howling. It wasn't long before we based our entire show around these characters, the princess and the priest. And so for 1 hour every night, the curtains would part and Valentine and I would step on stage and be ourselves. All of the laughter and jeering seemed to fade away the moment I saw the look in his eyes. The moment I felt his mustache grazing my cheek, as if we were alone. The act became so popular that I began to dress the part during the day. Our troupe figured I was working on my character. Passing townspeople would toss me a ruble, thankful for a laugh in their otherwise gray morning. But it was no act. and it was impossible for Valentine and I to confine our tenderness to the stage. We'd sneak into each other's quarters, first only at night, then during the day, and even while we were out with all of our blushing and giggling and passing touches, I remain astonished at how much everyone chose not to see. I felt safe. Until one day, when we were in a rented room above a tavern and I made the ultimate mistake. I had always bit down on a pillow or some bit of wool, desperate not to make a noise. I don't know if it was the feeling of safety or a weariness of hiding, but in that moment, I let go and I made the most joyous sound. A passing guest heard, thought I was in danger, and barged into the room. He saw us together, and there was no way to believe that was an act. The look on his face said far more than the word he mumbled.
No.
Before stumbling off. Valentine moved quickly, instinctively, dressing and running to our players, inventing a tale on the way. A great improviser, he told of a local police captain who had accused our troop of theft. That the captain was real and known for violence only colored his story with urgency. By the time Valentine finished, our entire troop was ready to flee the country and start over. And we did. We traveled as far as we could on land, then crossed the Bering Strait and finally settled in this Alaskan valley. All for me. He changed our entire world for me. It was strange to put down roots and become our own small village. Valentine started taking himself very seriously. The line between his act and reality faded. He seemed to believe he actually was the town priest, determined to invent a new religion, much of it poached from the Russian Orthodox Church, and the rest was whatever fancy struck him. We were now actors without a stage, so I understood that playing a role made him feel like himself. I thought he wanted the same of me, so I kept up my role as well, the princess in love with her priest. I've never been more wrong. It wasn't just that he looked at me differently. He looked right through me as if I were no longer there. I was the same person I'd always been, but suddenly Valentine was ashamed of me, of us. The person I'd known and loved became cruel and only to me. He had infinite kindness for everyone else. I was confused, unmoored. Then, one day he smiles at me, like his old self. I thought the spell had broken and we could be in love again. He apologized for his behavior, invited me out to this frozen lake he had found, said it was a beautiful spot where we could be alone. Of course, I didn't know the center of the lake was open. He pushed me in, made sure I stayed down, and started a tradition. I don't know why people return to the scene of their crime. I don't know why he made this religion. Maybe he thought it absolved him if everyone else jumped in. I do know he had one bit of luck. As he was explaining my transformation, a moose appeared in the distance and he seized on it. "There is our princess," he told them. "Our princess will live forever in this new form, and so can all of you in time." They bought it, and I have been cursed to float above and watch it all in silence in the role he forced me into. The ghost.
It's not the same albino.
Good one. Not the same.
It's not.
I mean...
These two are still in the woods, still looking for me. It's not common knowledge, but moose...
You mean hosts?
Yes, the hosts for our elders. They live 10, 15 years.
No, the elders live forever.
The souls of the elders might.
Might?
Do. The souls of the elders do live forever.
I know.
But they don't stay in the same host.
What are you saying? My Uncle Joe is...
Is still your Uncle Joe.
And my mom?
Still your mom.
Well, good then.
But...
Don't start.
Fish, there are some things you need to know.
Like, some of the moose die?
They all die. And we try to be there when it happens. We're not just caretakers. We're witnesses.
But how? I mean, you can't watch them 24/7.
We look for signs. If they move slower, eat less, maybe their routine changes. Anything like that, and we take more shifts, keep a close watch. Sometimes there is no sign, and they just up and wander in the woods. Deep, they find some place to be alone. We're not always there for it.
Then what?
We have a burial, perform the ritual.
No, I mean, how do you find a new host?
Oh, there's a test. We keep articles of clothing from the elders. Shirts, hats, anything.
I saw that you had one of Uncle Joe's shoes in the elders' chamber.
We do, yeah. And when the host for your uncle passed, we prepared one of those shoes as an offering. We took it out to find another moose, one that's about the same size, similar coloring. When we found him, we set the shoe on the forest floor, close enough for the moose to notice. He paused for a moment and then kept walking. We thought we'd have to continue our search, and then he suddenly stopped and walked back to the shoe, sniffed at it, picked it up with his mouth, and carried it away.
Because it belonged to him.
That's right. Steady. Calm your breathing.
Fish has one eye in the scope of an air rifle. The cluster of mushrooms on the side of an old tree go from fuzzy to sharp.
Good. Now, imagine the dart landing just above those turkey tails, as close as you can without hitting one.
Fish lifts his head to look above the rifle, gauging the distance to the tree. The mushrooms are barely visible from here. He relaxes his shoulders, calms his breath, and looks in the scope again. Makes a slight adjustment.
Gentle, gentle now.
Until the crosshairs are just above the mushrooms, dead center on the tree trunk, he hears a songbird, feels a breeze past his ear. Then he pulls.
How did you...
He just did what you said.
You closed your eyes.
You're not supposed to?
No.
The dart is just above the mushroom, so close that it appears to be resting on them.
I mean, it worked.
Do that again.
Okay.
He aims, closes his eyes to feel the wind, and the second dart lands right next to the first.
Go fish.
A pleasing tingle blossoms on Fish's neck and shoulders. He's being seen.
But seriously, learn to do it with your eyes open.
I mean, it worked.
It's not worth it. Something gets between you and the target. You don't want that.
I'll hear it, or sense it.
Val looks out into the woods, watches a magpie land on a tree branch.
Pemberton's retiring.
I heard.
Fish struggles to stand up.
And I can't coach hockey with this knee.
No, I mean from the elder caretakers. It's a full-time position.
I got a full-time position.
This one's more fun. Just learn to shoot with your eyes open, and you got the job.
Who said I want the job?
I saw that look from your mom. Back there, she saw you doing this work. That was pride.
Fish feels a grin spreading on his face and thinks of something that stops it cold.
But who would be postmaster?
Someone will step up. What?
He already asked everyone.
Carl did?
Yeah, I think so.
Back in town, the mailroom is empty. It's the middle of the day and all the carriers are out on their routes. All of them except Petal, who's here alone, finally able to use the mail sorting machine.
Where is the switch? Oh, there, huh.
She pushes a large green button. The machine chortles to life, barely. It seems like it might shut down and fall apart at any moment.
God, how old is this thing?
She's used to the newer models with conveyor belts and a gentle hum. This one sounds like an old tractor. She tilts a bin full of envelopes into the machine's rusty hopper.
Come on, buddy. Come on.
Myrna had gone home after lunch feeling nauseous. She said she ate too much, but Petal knows it's more than that. Her sister will jump into a frozen lake on Sunday. She won't come up, and the whole town is okay with it. That would make anyone ill. Petal wants desperately to help, but she doesn't know how. So she distracts herself with work, something familiar, something relaxing. But this mail sorting machine is not quite that. So far, only two envelopes have slid out the other end.
It can't be that slow.
She stops the machine, opens up the back, and finds a piece of mail jammed in the wheels. She pulls it out, ripping part of the envelope in the process.
How long has this been in there?
Then reads the postmark from 7 years ago.
Okay.
She closes the bag, starts it up again, and it's, well, better. That's one problem solved, but not the one that matters.
So after we tranquilize the princess...
We get her on the sled and drag her back to the pen.
And keep her hid until Sunday?
It'll be fine. Don't worry.
But then what?
I told you, just before Sasha takes the final plunge, you release her at the lake.
What if no one sees her?
Of course they'll see her, and everyone knows.
No plunge may proceed if the princess is watching.
Exactly.
It just seems wrong.
Why?
Each person takes the plunge at their time.
It's not her time. She's too young.
But she won. She won the game.
There's nothing in the scripture about taking the plunge because you won a game.
There isn't?
I made it up.
What?
I thought I was interpreting, but I was inventing. I saw what I wanted to see.
We have to stop her.
We're going to.
What were you thinking?
I wasn't. I haven't been for a long time. But I'm trying to change that.
Fish is pointing at a small pine cone on a rock about 100 yards away.
I bet I can.
All right, but eyes open this time. Seriously.
Fish takes aim, then slowly turns his head and looks straight at Val, eyes wide open, and pulls.
That is not okay.
I hit it, didn't I?
I don't care. Put the rifle down on the ground.
Why?
Put it down now.
Okay, geez.
Never do that again. Never close your eyes. Never look away from the target.
What's the big...
You might hit something else.
I haven't missed yet.
And spend your whole life regretting it.
I haven't missed yet.
They start following the moose tracks again.
I closed my eyes once as a kid. And I shot my dog.
You shot your...
Yes. I was 8 years old and... My dad was teaching me duck hunting. He blew the call and Betty ran into the grasses to send them up. I was supposed to follow them in the air with the rifle and count to three before pulling. But one duck flew straight at me. I got scared and closed my eyes and I did not count to three.
And you shot your dog?
It was quick. She didn't know. My dad thought it was a good time for a lesson. He told me to remember this feeling, that all of our traditions, everything we preach comes from a moment like this. Someone got hurt, and people wanted to make sure it never happened again. I just wanted to cry and be comforted, and he thought I needed a lesson. And it sure stuck. I haven't broken a rule, haven't veered from tradition, haven't done anything since then.
I can't believe you shot your dog.
Yeah, I'm finally making peace with it.
Your own dog?
Motherfucker, yes!
Whoa, Where did that come from?
I don't know. It just came out. Oh, sorry.
I've heard worse.
Like what?
Like dick face.
Dick face.
Ass wipe.
Do they all refer to privates?
Not all. There's others. Let's see.
Motherfucker.
Yeah, we said
that. Shh. Quiet.
Fish follows Val's gaze and sees it. The albino moose. The princess. Lying down in a cluster of young tamarack trees.
She's so far from her usual food sources. Why would she... Oh, no.
What? She's sleeping. Val. She's sleeping, right?
For me, this is the most beautiful thing. The sight of a creature having lived all of her days, as many as her body allows. A full life ending quietly. The albino rests her head, watches a snowfly crawl past until everything goes blurry. She closes her eyes. Her breathing slows.
What are we gonna do? Val, what are we gonna
do? I don't know. I don't know.
The air gets colder and what's left of the daylight is muted and gray. Back in town, smoke curls out of the chimneys. Headlights sweep past snowbanks as cars turn corners and head home. There's Carl and Mrs. Glass on the steps of her home, locked in a tight embrace. And there's Petal walking to her mostly empty apartment, unsure if she should spruce it up, unsure if she should stay at all. The youth hockey team is scraping away on a frozen lake at the south end of town, where Fish found glory and confidence. Maybe he'll find it again. I've been watching this town for 100 years, and there's something I've never felt before. My eyelids, they're heavy. They're so heavy. Have I really kept them open all this time? Finally, a moment of rest. I didn't know I needed this. Just a little rest.
I don't remember much from that night. I stopped vomiting around 8, managed to keep down some fluids, slept through the night and got woken early by a phone call from Carl, inviting me to Misha's for pancakes. I tried to get out of it, but he insisted.
Why didn't you tell me sooner?
I didn't know.
Why did Mom? For so long.
Well, she did the best she could. She did better than anyone could. I mean, look at you.
I knew that I looked horrible. Face puffy from the long sleep, my hair a tangled mess.
By the way, have you seen your sister?
She'll be at the lake tomorrow. We'll all be there.
I was looking for her yesterday. Her husband said she went for a walk. All day? Who goes for a walk all day?
She does.
Why?
She's done it all her life. When she needs to clear her head, she'll just start walking until she finds whatever she's looking for.
What's she looking for?
It's not what you think. It's not a reason to back out.
I have a reason.
Carl, you are the dad we needed, but right now I don't think it's going to help. It's too late.
I didn't know this at the time, but at another table, close enough to listen, my mom was quietly loading a bus tub. A single tear wobbled down her cheek. She contorted her face, blinked away her watery eyes, and carried the dishes to the kitchen. Meanwhile, Fish was in his new office. The chair was too low. It wouldn't raise, and it made him look like a child at the adults' table. Instead of a large roast in front of his face, it was a stack of paperwork. Delivery time, schedules, routes, a binder on management strategies. He looked away towards his new air rifle leaning against the wall in the corner, a gift from Val. The brass plate on the hilt, engraved with the elder caretaker's insignia, flashed for a moment in the sunlight from the window. He closed his eyes and imagined he's back in the woods. He could almost feel the wind, the soft push to the north. He could almost hear a bird fluttering overhead. Then, in the distance, a pine cone fell from high up, dropping, dropping, his air rifle in his hands, eye in the scope, crosshairs locked on the pine cone as it fell, the steel trigger cold on his finger, and then... Fish instinctively stood up, not wanting to be seen in such a low chair behind his desk.
Come in.
Morning, Fish. Postmaster, congrats again.
Thank you. Please, have a seat.
Petal sits in one of the chairs facing his desk.
You're not going to sit?
No.
She sets a form on the desk.
I was thinking...
Add it to the pile. Lots of paperwork here, so maybe by the end of the week...
It just needs your signature.
What is it?
A request for a new mail sorter. I guarantee you, when the regional office finds out how old our machine is, they'll send us a new one, maybe in 6 weeks.
I heard you fixed the old one.
Fixed is saying a lot. I got it back to 1970 speed.
I was wondering if you could look at my chair.
What's wrong with it?
Dried out.
You can't just tell me.
Fish motioned for her to sit, and begrudgingly she did, her chin level with the desk.
Ah, I see. You could have just told me.
She reached underneath to pump it up, and then it lowered back down.
Tried that.
Well, I don't know.
Then she slid the chair over and dragged another from the corner. A big purple chair, all tufted velvet.
That's for when elderly people visit.
Elderly people here? They're all,
Moose, we call them elders, and you're right, they don't visit or use chairs.
She sat down, leaned back, and put her feet up on the desk.
Now this is a boss chair.
And Fish finally sees it. Her confidence, her experience, her look that could silence a room.
You're right. It is.
Val had woken early that morning with an idea, and he went straight to the elder's chamber in the back of the church, opened the felt-lined drawer that contained clothing from the princess, and took out her lace glove. So delicate. And large. He soaked it in pond water for an hour, then strung it up, as was custom, 12 inches above a stand of votive candles. But it was taking too long to dry, so he lowered it. Then lowered it some more. And some more. And then it caught fire.
Fuck, fuck.
Oh, fuck.
He flung it in a bucket of water and watched it disintegrate. Then opened the felt-lined drawer again. Only one item left. A wool sock. Also quite large. At this same moment, Sasha was on another long walk, already several miles deep in the woods. For the past couple days, she hasn't been able to shake this idea that something about her plunge tomorrow will go wrong. But a long walk will fix it. It always has. One afternoon in the fourth grade, we were quietly doing our timetables when she suddenly got up and left. No one knew why. The teacher told us to have free time while she went to check. And that's when the boy my sister had a secret crush on gave me a Valentine. I declined him gently, and she never knew. The next year, she was petting Principal Markham's goat, which most kids like to do after school. But on this day, it was just her. She suddenly decided she needed a long walk. Once she was gone, a tree fell on that poor animal. It didn't feel a thing. The year after, she walks out in the woods and sees me fallen in the ice. Since then, I've never questioned her long walks. As she went deeper in the woods, Val had finished soaking the sock of the princess in pond water and was, safely this time, hanging it up to dry. Then he went about swinging his incense burner around the waxy branches of the red dogwood in the center of the room. The steps to this ritual are clear. Slowly circle the tree with incense and watch until a puff of smoke clings to a branch for 5 seconds.
1, 2, fuck!
It takes time, which he's running out of. The sun is getting higher in the sky and...
1, 2, 3. Fucking.
Once a branch has been chosen by the smoke, he may snap it off, cut it into small pieces, and insert them inside the article of clothing. In this case, a woolen sock.
1 fuck.
Then, find a moose of similar size and coloring, present the article of clothing. If they pick it up and carry it away, they are the new host. His idea this morning was to find another albino. A near impossibility in one day, but what else was there? If he could find another and prove she's the new host, he could still stop the plunge.
1, 2, are you fucking, no.
He drops the incense burner in a bucket of water, snaps off an entire branch of dogwood, and stuffs it in his pack.
It doesn't matter. This shit is like candy to them. They always pick it up.
A nagging thought has been repeating in his head, far off at first, but growing louder like an approaching train, and he can't ignore it anymore. He drops his pack to the floor and looks up at the mural of moose and elders painted on the high wall.
It's all bullshit.
It's real. It's all real.
In that same moment, Sasha, 4 miles deep in the woods, spotted an albino moose. A different one. Her ears were big for her size, and the white fur of her mane was long, jutting out to one side, as if she had been lying down in something damp. Sasha couldn't explain it, but the sight of this rare creature was just the sign she was looking for. The plunge tomorrow would go smoothly. She felt blessed, and she walked home content and glowing. And Val felt the exact same way. Finally letting go of all the rules and belief systems, he realized he could say anything. Tomorrow at the plunge, he could say anything and people would believe him. Stopping it would be the easiest thing in the world. So when Carl and Mrs. Glass showed up at his door that night, begging him to do something, anything to keep their daughter from taking the plunge, he was able to test out his idea. He told them the plunge would not go through. He told them why, and they believed him. They completely believed him. This was going to work. Later, at Mrs. Glass's home, Carl was asking about the delivery of their children some 40 years ago.
I'm so sorry I wasn't there.
Don't be.
But your husband... he took the plunge, and you were alone.
I wasn't alone. There was medical staff.
Oh, right. Like who?
There was the doctor.
The next morning, Val steps out onto the frozen lake, his white robe fluttering in the breeze.
He certainly knew what he was doing. I bet he could recite every line in the medical books.
And behind Val was Fish.
And there was the obstetrician. Awfully young.
Also in a white robe, but it was a little long, and he kept stepping on it.
Something happened last minute. The regular guy was sick, so they threw in this kid. He did all right.
My mom was standing 20 feet from the hole in the middle of the frozen lake.
I was a terrible patient.
She was starting to fall apart.
Shaking all over, getting angry, and for some reason I didn't trust anyone.
She had remembered that Val had never done anything right. Ever.
Thank God for that nurse. Kept wiping my brow with a damp cloth and saying the sweetest things.
But Carl held her tight and whispered in her ear,
"It'll be okay. Val's plan will work. Don't worry."
Then the clouds opened up, and a freezing rain began to fall, cold and sharp. Not being family, Petal wasn't at the lake. She was at work, looking at forms and reports, exhilarated at the thought of how much better the place could be run, and she knew how to do it.
Was Jan in charge back then?
That's right. She had just started running the hospital.
This place can be so much better. No one's had a pay raise in years. We could hire a mechanic and slap some new paint on the walls. And
I remember when she took over. It all just worked, and it felt good to be there.
Val and Fish were now standing at the slushy opening in the middle of the lake, their robes getting soaked. Sasha was the only one to bring an umbrella, and she was quietly standing before them. That's when Val looked at me. He was so hopelessly in love back then. I was too numb to care, and it was too easy to pretend I didn't notice. Fish suddenly remembered his role, and he began swinging the incense burner around Sasha as it hissed in the rain. Val nodded at him to stop and put up his hands.
"Before we begin, I must share a message that I received. Yesterday, I saw the host of the princess. She closed her eyes and passed. And just before passing, I felt her saying that the plunge cannot go on until the new host is found."
Despite the cold rain, Val felt a warmth spreading over his body. It was the simplest of lies because it fits so neatly in all of the others. Of course everyone would believe it. Then Sasha spoke.
"What time was this?"
1:14. I made a record of it.
"At 3 o'clock, I also saw the princess."
"What?"
"With her new host."
"No, that can't..."
"And she told me that the plunge may proceed."
I had never seen someone move so slowly and so fast at the same time. Sasha took one step forward and dropped.
"They say your body will flood with endorphins blocking the pain, but I sure felt it. And I'll never forget when that baby came out. And then the next, both times, I screamed louder than I ever screamed in my life."
I remember when Sasha dropped in the water, my mom lost it.
"No! No!"
But I didn't really hear that. My mom and everything felt so far away. That's when I walked to the center and let myself fall in after her. I didn't do it to save her. This isn't that kind of story. I knew I couldn't save her. I just couldn't let her go through this alone. I swam deeper and deeper, trying to reach her. And I remember thinking I might never find her. The water was so murky. But then, I felt the slippery end of her jacket, and I reached and grabbed onto her arm and pulled her close. We embraced and felt a warmth we had needed our entire lives. There was a time when we would hug constantly. There was a time when we were inseparable. When we were little and our mother would walk us to the market or the bank or the shoe store, we'd follow close behind, holding hands. This mostly charmed our mother, but also irritated her when she tried to teach us to tie our shoes or spread butter on the toast or shape an object out of clay. We were determined to learn every task with one hand, reserving the other for the warmth of each other's palm. When Mom would turn out the light and close the door, I would crawl out of bed and into Sasha's so we could hold each other until we were both asleep. Our favorite game involved the curtains in the front room. Sasha sat on one side, me on the other, both giggling and squealing as we surprised each other with random pokes and prods. As we grew older and tensions began to appear, we lost this touch, this warmth and closeness, and we never stopped searching for it. Sasha replaced it with her husband and later her children. I was never good with people, so I'd lay my hands, my face, my whole body if I could, on any warm object. Laundry out of the dryer, mailbags from the overheated mailroom, warm maple syrup on a plate. These objects were mild comforts, nothing like the warmth of my twin. We began as close as two people could, and we had to end that way as well.
When they placed those baby girls in my arms, it was like heaven opened up. I had never felt such meaning in my life, such joy and humility. I wanted so much to share that with you.
I'm so sorry that I wasn't there.
Stop saying that.
Okay. Sorry.
Can I get the moms? You know, they almost didn't make it. They were both the wrong way. They wouldn't turn. They almost had to rush me for a C-section.
We were going further down in the icy water. Everything was going numb and somehow burning.
At the last minute,
I saw these bars of light in the water and realized
they turned.
We weren't going down at all.
It was a miracle.
We were rising.
Val, what's that?
Fish was the first to see us. These dark forms down in the water, slowly taking shape.
Is that?
Val took one look and lit up.
Go to my truck. The towels and blankets. Get them all. Run!
Blankets. Towels. Run. Faster. Faster. That's it. Go, fish. Go, fish. Go, fish. Go, fish.
Val dropped to his belly, spread his weight on the ice, and grabbed our armpits.
I got you. I got you.
They put these two little angels in my arms, and they were sticky, and their big eyes couldn't see anything, and they were just breathing on me.
All of a sudden, my mom and dad, they had their hands on us, everyone pulling us up.
Paul! Almost there!
It must have felt like magic.
Push!
A small number of people in a room,
push!
And then suddenly, two more.
Whoa!
It was just like magic.
Cold Plunge was written and directed by Sonny Blechinger, starring Kurt Conroyd as narrator, Samiret Rios as Myrna Glass, Bruce Burkhartsmeyer as Carl Kowaleski, Claire Rigsby as Petal Bunce, Finley Vleer as Fish Oleski Pishkalnikov, Diane Kondrat as Mrs. Glass, Sonny Blechinger as Val Valentine Ivchenko. Children played by Olive, Nora, Juniper. Troop actors played by Doug Yarrow, Jennifer Yarrow, Yvonne Vleer. Russian voices played by Alex Chamberlain, David A. Grubkin, Cheryl Sandworth. Hospital staff played by Matt Corum, Tian Corum. Baby Crying by Rosa Eagleston. Casting by John San Nicolas. Recorded at Singing Sands Studios with sound engineer Callie Day. Mixing by Jeff Stewart Salzman. Sound design by Sonny Blechinger. Stunt driving by Evan Ling, Carl Christoffers. Story consultants Jacob Aiello, Matt Corum, Dan Glabitzi, and my name is Debbie Ann Taylor. This project was funded in part by a grant from the Regional Arts and Culture Council. Thank you for listening.
then push it back. I love it. Just a couple, maybe just sideways now.